This next session, we're going to turn to Romans chapter 1 in our Bibles. But I want to share with you that when I learned this truth that we're going to talk about this session, to me it was the most revolutionary idea, the most helpful concept that I'd ever come across in apologetics. That is, understanding what God says is going on in the heart and mind of every unbeliever. Because I grew up thinking, how am I ever going to prove God exists? How am I ever going to convince these people of something that they don't know anything about? Remember when I became a pastor, I moved into the parsonage at my church in New London, Connecticut, and I met our neighbor, and she said, oh, my husband will be so excited to meet you. He's a world's leading expert on Soren Kierkegaard, the philosopher. And my first reaction is, I'm never going to witness to that guy because I don't know philosophy. And once I learned this, I began to realize, oh, I can talk to anyone. It doesn't matter what they believe. So to me, this is the most important thing I learned. Tomorrow morning in the Sunday school hour, we're going to learn how to practically bring all this together. So I'm giving you a night to think about it, where you can be like all night long, like, all right, I know I should share the gospel, defend the faith, but how? You got to come tomorrow morning for Sunday school. I like to save things for, you know, bring it back the next day. But this is an important one. This is where God lets us have a look into what's going on in the heart and mind of every unbeliever. So let me ask you a question. If you could know the thoughts of any person, who would you want to know the thoughts of? Anybody? This is not, there's no right answer. How about parents with teenagers? Like, I'd really to know what my teenager was thinking when he did this, you know? Kids, anybody ever wish you could know what your dog was thinking? Or your goldfish? Like, yeah, that would help. Maybe men, you're like, I'd really like to understand what my wife's thinking. And your wife's thinking, oh, I know what he's thinking. He's thinking that I'm going to cook and clean and all that stuff for him for the rest of his life. Well, he's got another thing coming. I don't know. Whoever it is, maybe some of you, you'd like to know what your boss is thinking or whatever it might be. In Romans 1, God opens up and shows us what every unbeliever is thinking and believing when it comes to God. So let's notice, first of all, Romans 1, beginning in verse 18. Paul, through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, says this, "For the wrath of God," God's wrath against sin, "is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made, so they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things." So notice, first of all, what he's saying. Paul says that every believer already knows that God exists. So think about how radical this is. Every unbeliever you come across knows that God exists. And as we'll see in just a minute, knows some things about God. You might say, but Mark, there's atheists in the world. Yeah, we're going to talk about why that is. But every unbeliever already knows that God exists. Oh, you're saying they know that a God exists. No, that's not what the text says. The text says every unbeliever knows the true God. And here's the idea. We are either in a relationship of wrath with God or a relationship of grace. And this passage says every unbeliever is in a knowing relationship of wrath with God. That is, every unbeliever is aware from the moment that they have any sense of self-understanding, they're aware that they are guilty and that there's a God to whom they're accountable. And as they go through life, they have to deal with that. We'll talk about that in just a moment. What does this entail? It entails, first of all, that every person is made in the image of God. This is why everybody knows God, because they're made in God's image. In other words, they're made to reflect God. Therefore, they can't help but know the God that they're supposed to reflect. So if you know anyone, any poor child who looks exactly like one of their parents, okay, people all the time meet my son and they say, "I think I met your son." I said, "Oh, why do you think that?" "Because I met this younger version of you that looks like you, walks like you, talks like you." Now, if my son stood next to me and said, "I don't know who this old guy is," it would be pretty easy to see that he was lying because he sounds like me. He has the same mannerisms as me, sadly, for his sake. And what Paul's saying here is every unbeliever born into this world, because he's made in God's image, knows God and is aware of a few things. Because every person has the implanted knowledge of God. Five times in this passage, if you look down to verse 32, it says that the unbeliever knows God. Now, you can also look at verses like Galatians 4:8, where Paul says, "Formerly you did not know God," or 1 Corinthians 1:21, where we're told, "Man does not know God by means of his own wisdom and reason." The idea there is that man does not know God in a relationship of grace. That is, people are not born into the world in right relationship with God. This passage is focused on the fact that they know God in wrath. They're aware of their guilt, which is why even from the time little children, you know, are sometimes less than 2 years old, you tell them no, and you leave the room, and what do? They look around. They reach for. Why? Why do they have that sense of, "I have to be careful not to be caught"? It's because they're born with that sense of wrong, and if I do this, I'm going against what I've been told. Notice what they know, according to this passage, is that the holy nature of God and his wrath against sin are clear, plain, and well known. Parents, it's kind of like when you sit your kids down and say, "Okay, now listen to me, look at me in the eyes. I don't want you to touch the cake in the refrigerator. Do you understand what I'm saying?" "Yes, Mom." "Repeat the words after me. Don't touch the cake in the refrigerator." "You know what a cake is?" "Yes." "You know what a refrigerator is?" "Yes." "Do you know what it means not to touch something?" "Yes." And then what happens later? You come back and there's a big finger scoop through the frosting, right? That's what God says is true of every unbeliever. They're well aware of their guilt and sin. They're well aware that God's wrath is on them for it. And notice, finally, the unbeliever, this knowledge makes the unbeliever without excuse, as Paul says at the end of verse 20. Because they know God, they know they're guilty, therefore they have no excuse when they say, "Well, I didn't know." "Yes, but you heard me say, don't touch the cake in the refrigerator, right?" "Oh, I thought you meant..." "No, you knew exactly what I meant." And God says they're well aware of this. So think about unbelievers you know. I think about my neighbors. I don't have any unsaved coworkers at the Bible college that I know of. But you never know. You know, I could come across one. But people that I've worked with, people that I'm well aware of, as I'm talking to this person or encountering them in daily life, they know God and they're in a relationship of wrath with him. Therefore, when I start to bring something up about the truth or about the gospel or about Jesus, I'm telling them about something that they already know. So you might say, "Well, Mark, then what about, how do you get atheists then who deny that God exists?" Notice the end of verse 18. 18 says, "The wrath of God's revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth." That is number two. Oh, here's a great little cartoon talking about without excuse. Patient says to the doctor, "I have metal fillings in my teeth. My refrigerator magnets keep pulling me into the kitchen. That's why I can't lose weight." Obviously not a good excuse for not losing weight. That's what it means to be. By the way, the word without excuse here means without an apologetic. It's the Greek word apologetic again. So number two there, every unbeliever suppresses. That's supposed to be a picture of someone trying to suppress a sneeze. I couldn't find a better picture, but suppresses the knowledge of God in an attempt to escape the accountability. What does the word suppress mean? Suppress means to push down or hold back that which is trying to rise to the surface. So here's the picture. God says every unbeliever knows that God exists, knows they're guilty before him, but it's an awful thing to have to deal with, so they suppress it. Kids, you know what it's like when you get in trouble and mom and dad haven't caught you yet or come home, and there's that awful feeling like, oh, I'm going to get it. Oh, I'm in so much trouble. And you just want them either to come home and deal with it, or you might try to hide it, like, oh, it's okay. Mom's going to be merciful. She's going to be in a good mood. Dad's going to be too busy to notice. And you try to fool yourself into thinking that they're not going to notice that you burned the house down or something like that, right? You try to suppress the knowledge of that. God says that's what's going on in every unbeliever's heart. They're faced with the reality that they're guilty. That's too much to deal with, so they suppress it. Think about when you're at the pool or you're at the beach and you take a ball, you put it underwater. What does that ball always do? Pops right back up. If you put it underwater, it sank to the bottom, you'd think you broke physics or something, right? You'd be like, that's not supposed to do that. It always pops up. And this is the concept. Every day, the unbeliever goes throughout his day, and as he encounters things, it reminds him of the greatness and glory of God. As the text says, the knowledge of God is clear in the things that have been made ever since the creation of the world, both nature and how life on this earth works. Every day, in order to deal with that knowledge, that guilt, they have to push it down. And we'll see how they do that several ways. A good example, I think, is like when you're going along in your day and all of a sudden your stomach just kind of gurgles, right? Like, and you're thinking, ooh, that didn't feel good. And then it's okay for a little while, a few minutes. Then a few minutes later, a wave of nausea hits you. And your stomach goes, and you're starting to think, oh, no. Oh, no, I know what's coming. And over the next couple hours, those waves of nausea start rolling in. If I keep doing this, some of you are going to barf right then and there, right? And what are you doing the whole time? You realize, oh, no, I've caught a virus, a stomach bug. You're trying to suppress it. Like, nope, not going into worship that porcelain idol. I'm not going in there. I'm not going to go ride the porcelain Honda. I'm going to suppress it down. I'm going to hold it down. You try to, you know, my wife used to say, just mind over matter. Mind over matter. I'm like, I'm trying, but it keeps coming up, and I'm pushing it down. And then what eventually happens? You know, blah, it all comes out. Think about this. If what God says is true, every day the unbeliever is faced with the knowledge of God and faced with their guilt. And throughout the day, they're trying to push that down because they don't want to face it. And when you talk to them about the truth of the gospel, you're essentially holding their hands back, and that knowledge of God is rushing up. And that's why sometimes people get defensive. Sometimes people get angry. Sometimes people will say, I don't want to talk about this. Because you, by confronting them, by talking to them about the truth, you're holding back their hands, and they cannot suppress that truth. Now, if the Holy Spirit's convicting that person, drawing them, then they're like, yes, tell me more. But if you have someone who's not being drawn by the Holy Spirit to repentance, they are faced with the reality of what you're saying, and they don't like that. And so they suppress the truth. Notice in the text there, verse 22, claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man, and birds and animals and creeping things. So how do people suppress the truth? A couple different ways. Some people suppress the truth by turning to other religions. One of the big questions people ask in apologetics is, how can Christianity be true if the vast majority of the world believes in other religions? Well, there's a reason there's many religions, because since the time of Cain, since the time actually of Adam and Eve falling into sin in the garden, people have been suppressing the truth of God and deciding that they're going to worship God a different way, which eventually turns into worshiping a different God or eventually denying God altogether. So when you meet someone who's religious, I was born into an extended Irish Catholic family, and some of them married Italians, so we were Irish and Italian in the south end of Hartford, where all the Irish and the Italians lived. And for generations, the gospel never penetrated until my mom heard the gospel. So my mom was the first one saved. And when she would try to share the gospel with people at family reunions, man, the anger and the vitriol that came out, because they had their religion and it was good enough. And how dare you turn your back on your Irish heritage? And this is true anywhere, your Italian heritage, for missionaries in Russia, your Russian identity. That is, people respond because they've turned, by suppressing, they've turned to another religion. Here, think about, here's why. Why would a person not want to hear the good news of Jesus, that salvation's by grace, it's a gift? Here's why. Because in order to be saved, essentially what you have to do is to admit to a holy God who has every right to punish you with eternal judgment that you are guilty of that and you deserve it. And you have to hope in his mercy that he will give you salvation as a free gift. So in one sense, the Christian gospel is the hardest message of all. Because think about false religion. False religion says you're guilty, but there's something you can do to earn your salvation. So you can do something. You can save yourself essentially by your own works. That's more hopeful. And so most people would rather say, no, I can do good things and I'll please God that way. That's less scary than standing before a holy God and admitting I'm guilty. But also think about how easy the gospel is. Salvation's a free gift. I admit to God that I'm a guilty sinner, and God is faithful to always forgive everyone who admits they're a sinner and turn to Christ. The ugly thing about false religion is there's no religion in the world other than Christianity where you can know in this lifetime if you've done enough. So the burden of false religion is I have to try to earn my favor with God, and I will live my whole life and die on a deathbed somewhere, never knowing if I've done enough. Never knowing if I missed heaven or nirvana or paradise by one good work, I can never know. Which is why people in those religions live in constant fear. And growing up in an extended Catholic family, man, you see the fear when it comes to death. They are terrified of death because it all depends on them and they might not have done enough. So some people turn to religion, some people turn to distraction. That is, why do some people fill their lives with activity, whether it's social media and they're always on their phone or their iPad or their computer, or they keep busy 7 days a week with sports and activities and hobbies and fun? Because if you're busy and you never have time to stop and think about where you are with God, then you never have to face that. So good things become obsessions and distractions. Some people turn to substances. Why do people turn to alcohol and drugs and food and sex and entertainment and activity and all these other things? Because these things can dull the pain of my empty life or my guilt before God. So here's the thing. When I encounter an unbeliever, I know that they're suppressing the truth one of these ways or perhaps more. So one of the things I want to do as I'm talking with them is I want to show an interest in them as a person. I want to ask questions about what they really value, where they find hope, what they put their trust in, because I know it's one of these things. And when I find out what it is, then I can begin to address that issue and show how their attempts to handle that fail when addressed, and Christ is the answer. And let me tell you, this is powerful. Because when you begin to take time to ask people where they are, what's going on in their lives, what they believe in, what they trust in, sometimes they start to see for themselves as they're telling you. Some people will say, I've never told anybody this before. And they're telling you something because you're asking questions and they're revealing, here's what I really trust in, here's what I really think. And you're able to say, do you see the problems with that? Can I show you how Jesus is the real answer for that? A good example is I was on a plane a few years ago, and I sat down next to a guy, and he was a lot of fun. He was telling stories. He'd been in the military, been all over the world. So, like, the whole time we talked. It's like a two-hour flight. I think from North Carolina to Philadelphia, I fly a lot back and forth between those cities. And about halfway through the flight, he turned and said, so what do you do? And at the time I was teaching at Lands, so I said, oh, I'm a seminary professor. Oh, wow, that's so neat. I'm a Christian too. I mean, I haven't been in church in a long time, and but you know, I'm really, I think Jesus is a great person. And, you know, besides that one time he sinned, he was really an amazing guy. I said, come again? He said, you know, that one time Jesus sinned. I said, I'm pretty sure he didn't sin. He said, are you sure? I said, well, can you think of a particular instance where you think Jesus sinned? He said, I know. When he turned water into wine, didn't he like yell at his mother or something? I said, well, he did correct his mother because she wanted him to show his power. And he said, it's not time for me to reveal my power yet. And he goes, oh, so he didn't sin then? I said, no. He goes, like, oh, I'm really glad you cleared that up for me. And we talked a little bit further, and then all of a sudden he stopped. And he got really serious. And he said, we did some really bad things in Iraq. I didn't know what to say. He said, I was part of a forward operating base, and I was part of the guard system directing it. And he said, we had suicide bombers in our area. And he said, we had people that would come at the base and blow themselves up and take out soldiers. So he said, we had orders to shoot men at 100 yards if they would not stop coming toward us. And he said, we had orders to shoot women at 75 yards. And you know what comes next? And he said, how could God ever forgive me for what I did over there? I was able to share the gospel and talk about forgiveness. And I'm sure when he got on that plane, he wasn't thinking, man, I need to unload my heart on someone. Whoever I'm sitting next to, I got to share this with them. But because of the interest and because I challenged him in a few places and asked him about his life and where he found meaning and things like that, he began to see that, man, what I'm trying to do, I'm trying to live this life and it's not working for me internally, even though externally everything was good. He got to right to the heart of his issue with God. And it wasn't rebellion necessarily. It was fear that I'm guilty and God will never forgive me for this. And this is why taking time to ask questions and getting to know unbelievers is so important, showing genuine concern and interest in them. Because many times they'll open up and talk about things that they never would have imagined that they would share with you as a stranger or maybe even as a friend. But I know this, when I meet an unbeliever, in some way, they're suppressing the truth, either through their religion, through distraction in their life, through substances. And here's what happens. Notice suppression leads to several things. First of all, suppression leads to self-deception. So here's a picture of me looking in the mirror. I see in the mirror who I was when I was 26, when I was in my prime. But I know I'm not that in real life. And notice what he says here in verse 21. Although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking. The unbeliever does not think of spiritual things correctly because his mind, his spiritual mind doesn't work correctly. And their foolish hearts were darkened, and claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images. So people will begin to suppress the truth and they deceive themselves. Here's a good quote from George Orwell's book, 1984. He says, we're all capable of believing things which we know to be untrue, and then when we are finally proved wrong, impudently twisting the facts so as to show that we were right. Intellectually, it's possible to carry on this process for an indefinite time. The only check on it is that sooner or later, a false belief bumps up against solid reality, usually on a battlefield. That's why they say there are no atheists in a foxhole, because when you're faced with death, all that pretension goes out the window. Notice, secondly, suppression leads to irrationality. If you look at something long enough and deny it to be true, you will eventually become irrational. There's been psychological studies where they have a classroom full of people in on the study, and they bring in one person and he doesn't know it's a study, and the teacher holds up a blue pen and says, class, what color is this pen? And everyone says red except this one guy, and the guy's looking around like, no, it's blue. And they're all like, are you crazy? It's red. Let's try again. What color is this pen? And within a few minutes, that person will deceive themselves and become irrational enough to declare with the rest of the class that it's a red pen, even though he knows it to be blue, because of the pressure. And unbelief suppressing the truth has that type of impact. But if you suppress the truth long enough, you become irrational. Notice a couple examples here. Well-known intellectuals. Thomas Nagel, professor of law and philosophy. I speak from experience, being strongly subject to this fear myself. I want atheism to be true. That doesn't sound like a person logically looking at facts. I'm made uneasy by the fact that some of the most intelligent and well-informed people I know are religious believers. It isn't just that I don't believe in God and naturally hope that I'm right in my belief. It's that I hope there is no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the world to be like that. In other words, here's a man who supposedly is an impartial observer of the universe saying, I'm just going to see where the facts lead me. But a lot of atheists don't like Thomas Nagel because he says things like this. But this is the honesty. He says in another place, it's not that the facts lead me to become an atheist. I don't want it to be true. I don't want there to be a God, so I'm going to act like there isn't a God. That's irrational. Here's another one. Albert Leninger, biochemist at Johns Hopkins. His book on biochemistry is the standard book used in most colleges and universities today. He says, there's yet no satisfactory model or theory for the origin of the genetic code or where the world came from. He said, indeed, Francis Crick and Orgel have pointed out that it's not beyond reasonable possibility that genes in the genetic code may have been brought to Earth by, anybody want to guess? Spaceship. From some other body in the universe where intelligent life had already evolved. Of course, this idea is no answer to the problem, since one must then explain how life arose elsewhere. Here's a brilliant man. And what does he say is the founder of all things? Aliens. That's irrational, because there is zero evidence for aliens. Richard Dawkins, the author of The God Delusion, same thing, believes that aliens seeded this universe with the beginning of life. So how can someone be so intelligent and say this? Because they don't want God to be real and true, and therefore they say these things. Notice, thirdly, the unbeliever exchange or suppression leads to idolatry. That is, if I suppress the truth long enough, I will turn to something else and worship that, because you cannot not worship. David Foster Wallace was a famous novelist. Some said he was the next great American novelist. And he was an atheist all his life. And he gave a commencement speech at Kenyon College, I think in about 2005. You can look it up on YouTube, watch the whole commencement speech. It's about 20 minutes long. And in the middle of this, this famous atheist says this. There's actually no such thing as atheism. There's no such thing as not worshiping. Think about that. He admits, you can't not worship. Everybody worships something. The only choice we get is what to worship. If you worship money and things, if they're where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough, never feel you have enough. It's the truth. Worship your body and beauty and sexual allure, you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally grieve you. Worship power, and you'll end up feeling weak and afraid. You will need ever more power over others to numb you to your own fear. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, and you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. Brilliant insights from a guy who claimed not to worship God, but he came to realize everybody worships something. The sad thing is, shortly after he gave this commencement, he took his own life. In other words, here was a guy who understood belief and how it worked and that it was inescapable, but he couldn't turn to Christ. So notice the text says then that the unbeliever exchanges things. Verse 23, they exchange the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. So the first thing is the unbeliever exchanges the real for the fake. So about 15 years ago, I went over to China to teach in the underground church. It was kind of funny. They send an almost 7-foot white guy to China to teach secretly in the underground church. didn't quite work out as they expected. It drew attention for sure. But while I was there, I bought a Rolex watch. Beautiful. For some reason in China, they only cost $20. Here, they're $10,000. So I brought it home. I wore it for a couple weeks. Everyone commented on it. It was a beautiful watch. Until the first time I got water on it, and within a few hours, like the face of it steamed up. And the next morning I went to put it on, and one of the hands had fallen off. It was floating in water in the bottom of the watch. Why? Because it wasn't real. I don't think that happens with a real Rolex watch. And here's what's happening. If the unbeliever day by day is suppressing the truth of God, in order to stop dealing with the reality of the truth of God, he will turn to something else. He will turn to religion. She will turn to distraction. They'll become an atheist. They'll turn to something else in their lives. It's very much like, let's say, a soldier goes off to war, and while he's there, he has a picture of his wife and child in his helmet. And whenever he has a break, he takes his helmet off, looks at the picture, and counts the days so he can go home. And then he gets home, and he walks in the door, walks right past his wife to go sit out in the backyard in a lawn chair to stare at the picture. We'd be concerned because the reality is in the kitchen, and the image is only supposed to point to the reality. And the text says what happens is when people suppress the truth of God, instead of worshiping the truth, the glory, they turn to images. And notice the decline in dignity. Images, first of all, resembling mortal man, that is, images resembling people. Some of the ancient gods and goddesses look like people with powers. Think of superheroes today. That's kind of what the ancient world in Greece and Rome believed. And then it goes downhill to birds. In the ancient world, birds were higher than anything else because they could fly over and get a view of things like God could or the gods could. And then regular animals. And notice the last thing. Creeping things, crawling things, vermin, rats, snakes. The idea there is the more a person suppresses the truth of God, the more they lose their sense of humanity of who they are. So let's say you live next to a little old lady. She's faithful to her religion. She goes every week. She's a nice moral person. She puts money in the offering every week. Her suppression of the truth is going to look different from the person who says, I hate God, I don't believe in him, and I'm going to live my life of this, there is no God, and they live a very dark life. Both are suppressing the truth, but it looks differently. So again, when I encounter them, I know but that both these unbelievers are suppressing the truth of God in some way. They're suppressing truth that they know. So when I bring up God, they're going to react to that. They're going to disagree or get angry or get upset or not want to talk about it. And I need to learn to talk with them and engage them in a way that helps them to open up to talk about those things. Secondly, the unbeliever exchanges the truth for a lie. As the text goes on, it says, so God gave them up, verse 24, in the lust of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator who is blessed forever. Amen. And we talked about why would someone do that? Because if I turn to something else, I can earn favor with that God or gods by my own actions. And for some people, that's more attractive. And then thirdly, the unbeliever exchanges what is natural for what is unnatural. Verse 26, for this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. For their women exchanged natural relations for those that are contrary to nature. And the men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty for their error. That is, it's not saying that homosexuality is the worst sin here. It's saying it's the most obviously unnatural. And so the more people suppress the truth, the more they turn to other things. So when I'm engaging an unbeliever, I'm going to take the time to ask them about what they believe, who they are, what they love, what they consider most important, so I know where to direct my sharing of the gospel or my giving an answer to their objections. And this looks different in every instance. If you have a longtime friend who's an unbeliever, then you see this happen over numerous conversations, perhaps over years. If you're on a plane with someone or in a coffee shop, I think elevator is the hardest because you never know how fast the elevator is going to go. But the idea there is if I can find out a little bit about them, then I can target my sharing of the gospel to what their prime rejection of the truth is. And notice then, at the top of the next page, the more an unbeliever exchanges the truth for a lie, the more God gives him over to further spiritual blindness. And each of these cases where the unbeliever suppresses the truth, God says, you don't want to face the truth? Okay, I'm going to let you have what you want. And this is the scary part, because God does this in our lives sometimes too as Christians. If we're turning away from God, saying, I want something else, God will say, okay, I'm going to let you have what you want for a little while, and then I'm going to chastise you, I'm going to discipline you to bring you back to me, but you're going to learn that sin is never worth it. And God does that. It's kind of like the parent that tells the kid, don't do this over and over again, and the kid insists on doing it. Now, not things like put your hand in the fire, run out in the middle of a busy street, but if the kid wants to do something long enough, then maybe sometimes it's good to let them do it to experience the pain. You know, don't swing the bat around the house. You might hit yourself in the head. So kid hits himself in the head, he learns his lesson. The idea here is sometimes God lets people have, especially the unbeliever, he gives them over to what they desire, and the idea there is he's handing them over to something that will enslave them. This is why the unbeliever, the more he rejects the truth of God, the more he is enslaved to sin. And notice in verse 28, he lists more than 20 different sins. He says, and since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, he's speaking of all unbelievers, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. And notice the list. They were filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice. They're full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. They're gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Though they know God's righteous decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but give approval to those who practice them. Notice again verse 32, though they know God's righteous decree. There it is again. So think about it. Every unbeliever, this helped me because I realized when I meet someone, I'm telling them some things that they know. They know they're guilty before God. They know that they've done wrong. My skeptic friend Scott doesn't believe in right and wrong, he tells me. He's trying to be a consistent atheist. He's like, no such thing as right and wrong. So I said to him, he has two small kids, I said, are you saying that if someone entered your house and harmed your wife and kids, you wouldn't say that was wrong? And he knows that he's stuck in a corner. So this is his answer. I wouldn't like it, and as a society, we've learned that's not the best way toward peace, but I couldn't say it was wrong. And I want to say, you liar. You know that that would be wrong. It's more than just a different way or a way that doesn't lead to peace. It is wrong. And so the unbeliever I'm talking to knows these things to be true, suppressing them, and I need to ask the right kind of questions so I get to the heart of why they're refusing to face the truth. And by doing that, I help them see, and they see for themselves where they go wrong. So think about it then. Lastly, number three, the unbeliever's suppression of the truth. All the suppression of the truth is part of a complex system of belief. Sorry, I didn't give you enough space there. Called a worldview. So Ryan's been teaching on worldview. What is a worldview? It's the totality of how a person suppresses the truth, how they face up to, is there meaning in life? What's wrong with the world? Who am I? What's my purpose here? Where did I come from? Where am I going? All that is folded into their worldview where, for example, an atheist might say, I came here because of natural selection. There's no purpose in life. The only meaning that exists is what you make of life itself. There's no right and wrong, and when you die, that's the end. Every one of those is a suppression of the truth that they know to be true. And notice what a worldview is then. It's a commitment or a fundamental orientation of the heart. I threw in an extra that there as a bonus. That we hold about the basic constitution of reality. And that provides the foundation on which we live and move and have our being. We'll talk about this tomorrow afternoon more. when I'm talking to someone, I need to ask questions to figure out what their worldview is, and then I can begin to challenge those things. A good example would be this. Also, a couple years ago in the Lancaster Starbucks coffee shops, man, I have so many good conversations in coffee shops. I was sitting down, once again, studying, and a guy came and sat down next to me. And one of the opening lines I often use with people, if they have a book, is, oh, what are you reading? Tell me about it. I've also done things like, oh, that's a really interesting skull tattoo with snakes coming out of the eyes. Tell me about that. You know, things like that. Or if, you know, if I see a fellow New England Patriots fan, I'll say, oh, that's, just didn't know if any people are Eagles fans. Dan, you're probably an Eagle fan. I'll ask them about their sports team or something. But this guy sat down next to me and he was reading a book. And I said, what's your book about? And it was a book by Deepak Chopra, the New Age guru. And he said, oh, it's all about self-actualization. I said, ooh, cool. What's that about? And I just kept asking questions. He said, well, it's about how each of us ought to just pursue our own path in life and find self-actualization. I said, okay, so that was my in. So I said, so what happens if what you're pursuing to find your fulfillment conflicts with me? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, let's say that I'm bigger and stronger than you, and my path to self-actualization is cruelty and aggression. And that's how I find my true self. And so I steal from you. Let's say I take your wallet. What do you do then? And he sensed a trap. He's like, well, I think we just ought to each just pursue our own self-actualization. I said, I understand. But what happens when they conflict? He said, well, if you needed what I had more than I did, I would give it to you. I said, wow, you're a very generous person, more generous than me. But let's take it further. Let's say that while we're sitting here, someone goes to your house and cleans you out of everything you own, steals your identity, empties your bank account, because that's their path to self-actualization. He said, I still think if they needed it more than me, I'd give it to them. I said, oh, wow, that's amazing. I said, so you wouldn't call the police? He said, oh, no, I would call the police. I said, why? Why would you interfere with their self-actualization? If there's no right and wrong and we each pursue our own, you couldn't condemn that guy. And he said, you know, I don't like to talk about these kinds of things with Christians because they don't understand. All right, fair enough. So I went back to what I was doing. I respected, this is the part of the gentleness and respect. I'm like, okay, well, thanks for talking. I went back to what I was doing, and I noticed for the next 10 minutes, he went back to his book, but he never turned the page. So he just kept looking at his book, and finally he goes like this, you know that thing that you said about, and we went right back into a conversation about the gospel. So if I know that every unbeliever I meet is suppressing the truth of God in some way, I need to ask questions about who they are to find out what is their authority that they trust in, what provides meaning in their life that if taken away would make life seem not worth living, where do they find all their joy in life, and whatever that thing is, if it's not Christ, I want to ask questions and point things out to show them that it will fail them when they need it most, but Christ won't. And that's what we'll talk about tomorrow morning, is the method of the kinds of things that you ask and where you go with that. But this is true. Every unbeliever you meet knows God suppressing the truth. And that makes our job all the easier. I'm done. Questions. We have about 10 minutes for questions about that particularly, or any question related to apologetics. Questions unbelievers bring up. I know that's a lot to take in. Mike, good question. So is there any trend in people that are atheists? In my experience, no. A lot of Christians assume that if you're an atheist, you must have been hurt at some point, because why else would you reject belief in God? But that underestimates the power of depravity in our lives. Why do people become atheists? Because they don't want God to be real, ultimately. So sometimes it's because they've been hurt and they've turned away from God. My skeptic friend in town in Lancaster, he always does this. He shares his testimony. Oh, yeah, I was born again as a teenager. And then I went to college, I read the Bible, and it was reading the Bible that turned me into an atheist. And that shakes my students, like, Dr. Farnham, he said he was born again. I said, yeah, ask him the details about that. Because one time I did, I said, when you say that, what do you mean? And he grew up in a church, but it was not a church that preached the gospel. It was a church that preached moralism. And he basically had a religious experience, and he calls that being born again. So he was never a Christian. For him, it was, I think, for a lot of especially college-age students, is I don't want there to be someone to whom I'm accountable. I want to live my life the way I want. And he reads the Bible in order to look for things to argue against God. And so when he reads, for example, the book of Judges, all the horrific things that happen in the book of Judges, because we're told there's no king in Israel at the time and everyone does what's right in their own eyes, he takes that, all those things as, oh, these are things that the Bible approves of. See, you have a religion that's so awful. So he's not honest with the text of Scripture at all. For other people, last year when we were at Oxford, I met a Pakistani young man who'd grown up Muslim and rejected his faith. So he wasn't rejecting Christianity, he was rejecting Islam because he didn't like the way what he saw there. So there's all kinds of reasons. I think if there was a majority reason, it would probably be simply because I don't want anyone telling me what to do. The famous atheist Peter Atkins says, the thought of there being a divine being to whom I'm accountable is repugnant to me. So basically, he's an atheist because he doesn't want to ever have to give account to anyone. Good question. Other questions? What objections are you most afraid of encountering? Like, I would be scared if someone ever brought up this. Anybody have any particular objection to the Christian faith that you'd be worried about if someone brought it up? Sarah? Yes, yes, good. And I have a bunch of really good books on the back table. Christians, you're so intolerant. You're against LGBTQ. You're against, you're racist. You're against, you know, immigrants and all these different things people bring up. And I want to mention one of the books, one of the authors back there. I have three of her books, Rosaria Butterfield. She was a feminist, lesbian, tenured professor of English at Syracuse University. And in her book, Secret Thoughts of an Unlikely Convert, she talks about how she was researching a book on the religious right and how intolerant they were. And she was writing articles in the newspaper, and she would get letters from Christians, and she called that her hate mail. And she got letters from people in her LGBTQ community. She called that love mail. But she got a letter one day from a pastor in Syracuse who wrote to her, inviting her to come to dinner at his house with him and his wife, and that he, you know, wanted to share the love of Christ with her. And she didn't know what to do with it for a couple days or a couple weeks. And a couple times she threw it in the trash and pulled it back out because she said, I don't know which pile to put this in. And so she talked to her advisor. He said, oh, go to dinner. You know, these people are probably nuts, and it'll make for a hilarious illustration. So she went to dinner to this Presbyterian pastor in his wife's house, and she kept going back for an entire year, several times a week. And she said, they loved me as a person. When I would bring up, you know, arguments about my lifestyle and my beliefs, they would gently and kindly ask me questions. It would make me think. I'd come back a week later. And she said, it took a year for their just love for me as a person and occasional sharing of the gospel until I saw my need and she got saved. So that book, Secret Thoughts of an Unlikely Convert, is her testimony. And she talks about how it took more than a year after that for God to unwind her heart from the sin that she'd been in for so long, all her justification for it. And today she's a pastor's wife and is a wonderful Christian. She also wrote the book that Ryan gave out, The Gospel Comes with a House Key, on hospitality, using your home to win people to Christ. And so, yeah, powerful testimony. So typically when people raise that question, I will do one of two things. I will say, are you intolerant about anything? And a lot of people say, oh, no, I'm tolerant about everything. And then I'll bring up some heinous sin or crime and say, so you're okay? Oh, no, not that. Okay, so you're intolerant of some things. If I can demonstrate that everyone's tolerant and intolerant of different things, then we're on the same playing field. And then when the issue of sexuality comes up, and they challenge that, I'll say, this is what I believe. I believe God created sex for good. I believe it was his design. But I believe all violations of that are destructive. And I typically use the word destructive as opposed to sinful, not because they already know that I think it's sinful, because I want them to see that I'm opposed to things that are destructive. And that tends to draw them in. They're not so defensive. Well, what do you mean it's destructive? Why is it hurting anyone? And then that opens up the door to say, well, what do you think? When a man leaves his wife and leaves her all alone with kids, you know, and commits sexual sin, like, do you think that's destructive? Oh, yeah. Okay. So here's the point about Christian belief in all things is that sin is destructive. And while you may not see these particular sins as destructive, God says they are, and that's why we hold to it. And yet we love people, and we want them to come to Jesus. We want them to know the truth. That still doesn't satisfy everyone, but it does diffuse the idea that we are hateful. And that's why in our, let me encourage you, in your online presence, the comments you make, the things you post, do not post things that are inflammatory. Because I have a lot of unsaved people as friends on Facebook. It's not that sometimes I post things that confront sin and societal decay, but I never post anything that needlessly seeks to offend, because I want them to know that I love them. And I could go on and on about that, but a good example is just this week my wife got a contact from her uncle, who's been a practicing homosexual for 35, 40 years, and we've lost contact with him for about 10 years or more. And he contacted her just this week and said, would you come and visit me? He's probably in his 70s now. And we'll probably go visit him, because we tried to maintain a good relationship. He knew where we stood. I was a Baptist pastor. He had no questions about where we stood on his lifestyle. But we left the door open for relationship there, because we wanted them to know that we will always want a relationship with you, and yet we won't budge on our view, but our biggest concern is that you would come to Christ. And here's the big thing about reaching people that are very different from us in lifestyle. We don't want to avoid the topic, but if I can focus on Christ, if Christ saves them, he's going to take care of all that. So that's got to be my focus. That's a very long answer to a short question. Time for one more question. All right, you've done remarkably well. Especially the kids, man, the attention is fantastic. If I had $20 to give each of you, I would, but I don't. For some reason, I have no money in my wallet, probably because I still have a child at home. But let's pray, and then I'll turn it over to Ryan for announcements for tomorrow.